The Wintrust Business Lunch is up and running. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. This is John Williams. Thanks for dialing in. Elise Glink joins us on Mondays. She's the real estate and financial wellness expert. 100 questions every first-time home buyer should ask is her book. And the website's thinklink.com. Welcome back, Elise. I hope you're good.
Hey, John. Things are great.
Is real estate still good? What's the trend right now?
Well, we're seeing mortgage rates hit basically 5-month lows. So they're touching the lowest level since February, meaning that people who have good credit, who go out to refinance, are probably looking at getting something sub 3% on a 30-year fixed and maybe even as low as 2.5% on a 15-year loan.
I thought I heard, though, that some of the real estate frenzy was starting to level off.
Yeah, it is. We're seeing less insanity, especially in Chicago, but it doesn't mean that the market has completely died off. And part of this, I think, is cyclical. It's just running a bit late. So typically we see in sort of later stage of June and July, a market will slow down and just get back into a more relaxed period as people who wanted to sell after their kids graduated got those sold, they're moving. People who want to be in place for the fall have typically done that. This year, though, everything is kind of in a a flux, right? So I think what we're seeing now as we begin August and have seen maybe for the last couple of weeks is a market pause. We're seeing people just kind of slow down a little bit. But I do think that low interest rates are going to continue to propel this market forward. And the reason I say that is we're seeing a lot of off-market deals happen, deals that don't even get to the multiple listing service.
Yeah.
People are selling privately.
Is that on Facebook?
That's from my super secret knowledge centers that we talk to. But we're hearing this from real estate attorneys and from brokers who are saying that they're selling privately and it's going so quickly that those homes don't even reach the multiple listing service, so they aren't made public until later.
And I'm not kidding, though, when I say that I've heard that some people are listing it on Facebook, and I'm not sure it's the Facebook marketplace or just, hey, everybody, we're selling our house for X price at this address, and they do the deal, or at least initiate the sale, start it on Facebook.
No. You're absolutely right, John. We're also seeing more signs, almost homemade signs, like coming soon with a phone number in front of a house. No branding. These are typically flippers who have bought property quickly. Maybe they did a coat of paint. Maybe they did something more. And now those houses are about to come back in the market. And what they're trying to do is sell it privately again by people who are just driving around neighborhoods looking for signs. It's gotten very old school, actually.
Yeah.
We're getting offline and back into our cars.
It's funny because, I just wanted to mention this too. Friends of mine sold their condo downtown, and it's not in a location where you'd think the prices are going to escalate and everybody's going to sell it in 24 hours because it's so hot. This is not people running to the suburbs. This is people trying to sell their house downtown. And they were able to sell it in 24 hours. I don't recall the price. I don't know if they went up or down or whatever. But my point was this. Their house was super clean and it was super ready. And I wonder if you would comment on what are some of the most important things people should do to their home if they're trying to sell it.
Sure. I think one thing, the cleanliness thing you mentioned actually has a psychological component to it. So when somebody goes into a property, what they want to do is they want to feel like the property is taken care of. If you have a dirty, filthy house with dust bunnies all over the place, that communicates to the seller, to the buyer rather, that there may be other problems with the home that's hidden, right? That you haven't tackled because you can't even do something as basic as, sweep the floor. So when you go into a property, what buyers really want to see is, really clean, white walls, sort of modern fixtures, and nothing that they have to redo, per se. They're putting so much money into your property, you're going to get top dollar. They're basically financing in all of the renovations or the upgrades that you've made. And even if you don't want to do a full kitchen remodel, for example, or bathroom remodel, a coat of white paint that's fresh and clean, making sure that everything is in good repair, the doors are closing properly, and you don't have dents in the walls, all that goes a long way towards getting your home sold quickly.
Don't you suppose this is true, too? Like, yeah, you're probably not going to have dust bunnies, but if you do an extra level of clean, it almost on a psychological level works for people. They're like, I don't know why I like this place better, but I do. And it may be because there's no scuffs on the baseboards, you know?
Yeah, it smells fresh, by the way. And you can get your carpet clean. That's a good thing that goes along with painting. Make sure that the drapes are clean. Things that are even sort of silly and that will go with you. When Sam and I sold a condo years and years ago, you know, we basically went out and we bought all new linens and bedding. And so the bed looked like a Pinterest, basically. I mean, we went to Pinterest. We're like, oh, that'll look good. I mean, even to the point where we had these fake flowers that sat on the side. We staged the property. And I think that you can't underestimate as something to do after you've cleaned it. Staging is something that's helpful because people are looking at these properties after they've been watching HGTV or looking at Pinterest or what have you. And they want to feel like the place they're buying will look like that when they move their stuff in.
I'm amazed when I look at pictures online how staged some of them aren't. Like, they still have the dishes from breakfast on the table, and they just stood back, took a picture, and says, ah, this will sell. You know, it's a hot market. I don't even need to move the toast off the thing. It's like, really? What were you thinking? And I think that stuff does make a difference. I'm interested to hear you say that.
Yeah, no, it does. And the other thing that I think makes a difference, and I didn't really appreciate this until I saw the photos of a house my sister bought, is how having a photographer who specializes in real estate can make your property look bigger and better than it actually is. And that's incredibly important to just getting people through the door. And so don't underestimate when the real estate agent says, well, we need some new photos. The lighting that goes into it, the camera angles and lenses that the photographer uses, all of those can be done to your advantage.
Lise Glink's online, and I also wanted to talk to you about a company called, Square, right? Yeah, Square.
But right, and Afterpay.
We'll pick it up here in just a minute. So what's this Square company about?
So Square is a little, literally, white square that plugs into your phone, and it allows people to charge things if you have a company, like a small company. This is another way to do those kinds of charging.
Oh, I've seen those. Sure.
Sure, right? You know, you take an Uber or you take a cab, and sometimes they have you pay by Square rather than going through the company. And then Square obviously takes a, you know, whatever their percentage points are. They have built a massive business over just a few years. Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, is the founder of Square as well. It's been wildly successful. And today they announced that they were going to buy a company that is in a very hot new area of fintech, this buy now, pay later trend, and it's called Afterpay. And there's a couple of different competitors that they have, but this is really the latest trend now for consumers and for retailers.
You know who uses that, Bertha, the lady that cuts my hair? When you go to craft shows, a lot of times the retailers out there, you know, if you got cash, great, but maybe you don't have the cash, and they just scan that with the Square.
Well, that's paying for it with a credit card. But what buy now, pay later is basically, this is a very old-fashioned thing where you used to pay on installments, right? And so now, instead of having the consumer pay the financing charges, buying something on the installment or the layaway plan, you may remember that from, you know, I don't know, 50 years ago.
Sure.
Instead, you've got big retailers that will pay the fees to Afterpay or to Klarna, is another company that's, I think that one is Swedish. They're also coming to the U.S. And huge companies will actually pay the fees and allow people to buy it on time at 0% interest. And so the amount of revenue that these companies have been able to generate in just a few short years is nothing short of insane. It's huge. And it turns out there are a lot of people who will be happy to buy at 0%. And what they're doing is they're spending more than they normally would have.
Yeah, I guess that's it. I mean, that's 0%, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. And it's putting pressure on other kinds of companies that exist where they do charge interest rates to finance large purchases, whether it's appliances or furniture. It's not just clothes, where a lot of the retailers are doing clothes, but it's other bigger ticket numbers as well. And it's interesting to see just how many people are buying these things. Now, you know, the question that I, as a finance person, ask is, you know, what is the, you know, sort of long-term ramifications if you've got people spending, you know, $1,000 or maybe even $5,000 on a buy now, pay later kind of a thing, you know, and what happens when you start missing those payments? And so what Afterpay has done is they stop allowing you to buy new things as opposed to a credit card where you may be encouraged to keep spending.
That's fascinating. I also wanted to ask you about IRAs. There was a Senate finance hearing about this Wednesday, and it seems like there's two different standards for IRAs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, I think that the is this about the hijacked IRAs, or is this, I guess I'm not quite sure which part of the IRA that you wanted to talk about, but
I'm looking at a ProPublica story today, and it's about tax-free Roth accounts, big mega Roth accounts, more than $15 billion held by a small number of Americans. Are you looking at the same story I'm looking at?
I don't know if I am, but I do know a little bit about these. So what happened was pretty interesting. So when you have a Roth IRA, this is after-tax money.
Right.
And what some really smart people do and have done, like Peter Thiel, who now has $5 billion in his Roth IRA, which is all grown tax-free, you know, there's been a little confusion about what these were originally intended to do and what sort of ordinary people like you and me are able to do with our Roth IRAs, which are limited. You know, the amount of money that you can earn in a given year, you know, it's limited. It limits the people who can contribute, and then you're limited to how much you can contribute. But
Right. People
like Peter Thiel, who also use advanced tax strategies to bring down their gross income and their adjusted gross income to levels that would allow them to contribute and then put in things that they know are going to, you know, dramatically, they seem to be worth zero when they go in, but really they're not. I think what they're trying to do is look at ways to limit people being able to do that, because that money all grows tax-free.
Yeah, no kidding. If you've got $5 billion in a Roth IRA, the limits that all of us are subject to is $2,500 or something like that. I mean, pay the taxes on your $5 billion. Now you'll have $4 billion. You'll still be a billionaire. That's crazy.
Yeah, I don't understand. I really don't understand people who have that level of wealth feeling like they need to not pay taxes and not contribute to the public good when, you know, really, you know, our society as a whole is what is also contributing to that. And when you pay your taxes, that's what you're paying for. Things like, you know, roads and bridges and schools and, you know, people who are going to end up, you know, getting educated so that they can work for your companies. But this is, you know, these very, very wealthy people are doing an end run around these, and they're getting advice from tax people, and so far it's been totally legal. And I think what the Senate is trying to do is figure out ways to rein that back a little bit, so people who have that sort of net worth can't use vehicles that are designed for ordinary people to help us get to some sort of savings for retirement.
You know, when you say I don't exactly understand why people are that way, I think that it's the other way around. That is, the way to get super rich is to be of that mindset. You know what I mean? That's a tenet of rich people, is that they're always trying to find, not only, put it this way, yes, they have great energy and acumen, they're talented, smart people, but they're also of a certain makeup that they want to avoid expenses at every turn. And lo and behold, that gets you to be a billionaire. Now you're a billionaire. It doesn't mean suddenly that desire to not pay taxes is switched off. You know, that's what got you there. That's who you are. So they're still that way, even though now they can certainly afford to pay their share of taxes.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a lot of people who, because of the stock market or because of the fintech explosion, are now worth a tremendous amount of money. And in fact, there's another study that was released yesterday or today that showed that the number of people with $5 million or more in their 401k accounts or in their IRA account, not Roth IRA, regular IRA, mm-hmm. is now at it has tripled over the last few years, and there's now over 28,000 people in the country with that sort of wealth in a 401k. And it's, I think it's certainly worth looking at ways to find, you know, and support other people who want to put more money into their retirement accounts. There's kind of these arbitrary limits that have been set up on how much you can contribute of your income to your 401k, not sure why those limits are there, how much you can contribute to an IRA. It would seem to me that it would be in everybody's interest to let everybody contribute what they want, but you still have to pay the taxes on it. And with a Roth IRA, it's really tax exempt.
That's Elise Glink. You can check her stuff out at thinkglink.com. We'll talk next Monday. Thanks for your time today, Elise.
Thank you, John.
Mondays, we frequently visit with Jim Dahlke, and there he is again. Hey, Jim, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Hey, John, doing great. Thanks for having me.
Jim's a senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. Kind of intrigued by the story you wrote about the Lincoln Park Zoo and how the animals reacted when there were crowds and when there weren't crowds. What's this story?
Yeah, so, you know, the Lincoln Park Zoo, like, you know, pretty much every business, right, experienced, you know, extended closures during the COVID pandemic. And, you know, it was really unique to the Lincoln Park Zoo because really in its 150 year history, it never really experienced a closure like that. It was very unique and new to the zoo. And, you know, one thing that the zoo was curious about was, you know, how were the animals going to react when there were no people around? And, you know, how are the animals going to react when people came back? And, you know, luckily for the zoo, there's an app for that. It's called Zoo Monitor. And actually, it's an app that was created in-house in Lincoln Park Zoo back in 2016. And essentially what it allows the zoo to do is sort of monitor the movements and the whereabouts of the animals in their habitats in real time. Some volunteers are joined to work with it as well, basically kind of documenting how animals moved throughout the day. And what they did was sort of take a look at how did animals move, you know, during those closures when nobody was in the zoo compared to how they moved before. They also looked at how animals moved when visitors came back. And so, you know, basically what the zoo found was that there was actually very little change in some of the animal behaviors. Most of the animals actually acted very similarly to how they did prior to the closures. There were a couple of exceptions. The cliff springers, these are small antelope species, they sort of increased their foraging and exploring kind of within their habitat when people were gone. So, you know, they're kind of a nervous animal by nature, and, they were a little more outgoing when people were not around.
Was it a kind of a Fitbit, or is it people just watching them?
Yeah, so this is basically volunteers and zoo handlers, zoo personnel watching them and monitoring their movements in real time. So this app that they created, you know, sort of allows you to mark where within the habitat these animals kind of go and where they spend their time. It's a really interesting app, actually, that has led to some pretty impressive changes to the zoo itself. A certain animal species that they followed several years ago, they realized that when it got above 70 degrees, these animals only stayed within these shaded sections of the habitat, so they're able to provide more shade and, you know, sort of change the way the habitat works. And the zoo actually has provided this app for free to any other zoo around the country, around the world, and actually it's been used by almost 700 zoos and aquariums in 50 countries across the world.
Baking was a big part of our coping with the pandemic. Are we still baking? And there's a company that's trying to capitalize on that, right?
Yeah, so there's a new startup in Chicago called Bake It Box. And essentially what they are is a meal kit service, but for baking. So think Home Chef or Blue Apron, but specifically for baking. It was a business that launched last year in the pandemic as baking really, really took off as an at-home activity. You know, the founders realized that it was just kind of hard and messy and complicated to do at-home baking. So they wanted to take a Blue Apron approach, but for baking. And so that's what Bake It Box is. And so really what they're able to do is provide you a kit to your house that allows you really clear simple directions and all the, you know, pre-done ingredients that you need to make certain items. So no longer does your kitchen counter need to be covered in flour, right? You've got the exact amount of everything that you need. So yeah, this company really betting that baking is not just a 2020 pandemic fad and that, you know, people will want to continue to do that for years to come.
Can you distinguish it between that and a box of Duncan Hines? I mean, I can already get a sort of bake it box. It's called the grocery store and there's a whole row of them. I wonder how these cakes would be different.
Yeah, you know, what they're really focused on, too, is kind of, you know, cultural ingredients. So empanadas are a big one for them. Tres leches, you know, they're a company that really kind of values, like, you know, a culturally diverse group of different types of recipes. So, you know, they believe with, you know, a really simple ingredient list, a really simple recipe to follow, that it'll make, you know, baking even easier. So, yeah, there are a few different ways to kind of do this. But, you know, they're kind of really taking the meal kit approach here. And, you know, eventually they say they're going to operate a subscription service as well. So if you want a box a month, a box every 3 months, boxes around the holidays, for example, there's definitely a seasonality element to this, too. So they think that this is the subscription feature could be really interesting here.
One last story. Let's just talk a little bit about retailers or ATMs popping up at retailers using Bitcoin. What's going on with the Chicago company on that?
Yeah, a Chicago company called CoinFlip, founded in 2015, actually by currently a couple of 26-year-olds today, and they went to Deerfield High School together. And they're helping you buy and sell Bitcoin from an ATM. Most Bitcoin users, you know, probably are buying and selling via their phone, right, whether it's a Coinbase or a different kind of digital wallet. And what they're doing is helping you do that with cash in an ATM. And this business has absolutely exploded. They've done $50 million in revenue last year. They've brought their ATMs 2,500 ATMs across 47 states, just three states left to get into. Really, really kind of growing like gangbusters here and doing it with no venture capital funding either, totally bootstrapped.
No kidding. And what's the name of that company again? CoinFlip, huh?
CoinFlip, yep.
A couple of Deerfield High School grads, huh?
I know, 22, 26-year-olds who are leading this thing, which is really incredible. Yeah, over 200 employees now, too.
Wow.
And it's really impressive. And one thing that they've figured out is customer service. If you try to figure out an account problem with some of these digital apps like Coinbase, it's really hard to get in touch with somebody. They really sort of value customer service and, you know, have done tens of thousands of customer service calls and expect to do many more.
Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Eno. Okay, let's talk again next week. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, John.
Amy Goose got some interesting stories, too, including this is just shocking to me. One in every 169 workers in America has what in common? We'll get to that in a minute. First, let's get you more business news, and this is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new report says parking apps have fully recovered from their pandemic lows, and that's good news for companies like Chicago-based Spot Hero. According to the data firm Aptopia, usage on parking apps is 6.2% above January 2020. People appear to be more comfortable driving right now than taking public transportation, with U.S. traffic levels up 55% in April compared to the same time last year. Spot Hero has been the second fastest growing parking app in the U.S. based on year-to-date monthly downloads. A minority-owned investment firm that's been a fixture in Chicago for more than two decades is planning an initial public offering sometime next year. Loop Capital Markets saw its revenue more than double last year to $200 million. The firm's CEO, Jim Reynolds, tells Cranes he expects it to reach $1 billion valuation before the IPO. Loop Capital Markets has benefited from corporate clients switching to minority-owned vendors as they seek more diversity and inclusion. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Steve Alexander's got the business of food.
Yes, sir. Let's begin with coverage of the Tokyo Olympics and the women's 1,500-meter qualifying races last night. The USA's Ellie Puryear-St. Pierre moved on to the semifinals on Wednesday. And it may seem like I'm veering into Dave Ennett's territory here, but I'm not. Ellie, one of the fastest women in the world, is also a dairy farmer.
She's actually a fifth-generation farmer.
That's Ellie's husband.
I'm Jamie St. Pierre from Pleasant Valley Farms in Berkshire, Vermont.
Quite likely the only dairy farmer in the Olympics, Ellie was the top qualifier among U.S. women, and
she has the American record in the indoor mile and 2 mile.
Jamie and Ellie have known each other since they were little kids, growing up together and eventually starting dating, and doing so in the way that only farm kids can.
Our first dates growing up were unloading small square bales at our parents' farm, or she would come ride with me in the tractor while we were haying. Or, whoops, my heifers are out, Ellie, can you help me go put them back in and fix the fence?
And when it came time to pop the question?
Ellie actually always wanted a brown Swiss, so when I proposed to Ellie, I bought her a brown Swiss heifer. And it was pretty neat. That brown Swiss heifer had her calf on the very day that Ellie flew from Boston to Tokyo.
Ellie picked up an endorsement from the Dairy Farmers of America, one of the largest dairy co-ops in the country, and she is taking advantage of her dual role as an Olympian and a dairy farmer to spread the word.
It's one of the most exciting things of her getting her name out there, is to be able to use her platform to help people understand dairy farmers, farmers in general, and also dairy products. There's a lot of misinformation out there in the world, and there's not always great sources for people to get the correct information.
Jamie St. Pierre, proud husband of Olympic runner and dairy farmer Ellie Purrier St. Pierre. She'll race in the semifinals on Wednesday and, fingers crossed, the final on Friday. At the Chicago Board of Trade today, lots of buying going on, with corn now up about 13 cents, beans are up 7, and wheat is trading about 27 cents per bushel higher. Today's Farm to Your Belly feature has a dairy connection. It's National Ice Cream Sandwich Day. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us on the Business Lunch. I said one in every 169 workers has what in common? I guess I shouldn't be surprised by the answer to this, Amy. What is it?
It is, that means they work at Amazon. I was surprised by that number. I knew it was such a large employer, but to see that one out of every 169 people in the U.S. workforce work for Amazon, it was kind of, you know, to put it in those terms, part of that is because it's always been a little bit unclear how many employees Amazon has. This information came out kind of in an indirect way. They put out a press release that was pretty long, and there was a section in it about employee safety and providing good jobs. And in that section, they were talking about a new mental health benefit that they're offering their workers, and they named that number, 950,000 U.S. employees. So that's almost a million people that work for Amazon. The only company bigger is Walmart. One out of every 100 people in the U.S. workforce works for Walmart. So that makes Amazon the second biggest private employer.
And says something then about big boxes. I mean, for a lot of us, Walmart is kind of like Amazon, at least as a store. Well, let's see, is there such a thing as an Amazon store? I guess I'm thinking of Sam's Club and Walmart. But the big box employers then really do house a lot of American workers.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, Walmart has really made a lot of moves over the last couple of years to try to compete with Amazon in that e-commerce space. Through Walmart.com, they had a program that they rolled out that's very similar to Amazon Prime, trying to, you know, compete with that business. And there's an interesting detail about the Amazon number that I think is also worth mentioning, and that is that number, one out of every 169 people in the workforce, that does not include contract workers. So all the drivers, all the people that are doing contract work to get our packages to us, they are not included in that number. I would love to see that number adjusted for that, because I bet it's much closer to that Walmart number at that point.
They pay $15 an hour, is that right?
They do. And they mentioned that they have paid that since 2018. So that's more than double the federal minimum wage, that they've been at that number since that time.
And I suppose they would remind us that not everybody's making 15. Some of their employees are probably making more. But that's almost a trivia question. That's a fascinating number. One of every 169 employed persons in the United States work for Amazon. Ferrari's earnings are up. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you and I talk about cars a lot, but it's usually we're talking about bottlenecks and supply issues and things like that. But Ferrari put out some numbers earlier today that I thought were really interesting. So their second quarter growth was pretty unbelievable. They have a record number in orders. And they also noted two things I thought were very interesting. The average age of new Ferrari buyers is going way down. So people are buying their first Ferrari younger and younger. And also the number of women that are placing orders has doubled, which I thought was very interesting that they are tracking that. So shipments of orders doubled in the second quarter. So they shipped over 2,600, and net revenues, of course, went with that. They that revenue was over €1 billion. So their total was 571 billion a year earlier. So it's up from that. You know, we've talked so much about cars here in the U.S. and a lot of bottleneck issues, but it seems like the luxury car, you know, end of the market is kind of its own game, doing its own thing.
Yeah.
Ferrari also announced they have a new CEO, who is an Italian executive from Europe's largest semiconductor chip maker. So that chip maker story does factor in here in some way, but in a little bit different way than we have talked about with U.S. cars.
Yeah, I was just talking to a U.S. car seller today, and that chip thing is still a big issue. The inventory is down, and that's the reason why, and we're out of time. Amy Guth, let's talk again later this week. Thanks, Amy.